This is a Stimulus Network podcast.
Hello and welcome to Eureka Nerd. I'm Will.
And I'm Leah.
And a quick warning before we get into this episode. We say the phrase Alexa a lot. If you're listening to this within earshot of a Alexa or Amazon Echo device, you may want to turn off activation on those, possibly also for any Siri or Google-like devices.
I don't think we mentioned those, but...
In case.
We're talking a lot about smart speakers.
Mm-hmm. This episode is all about digital privacy, and joining us to discuss that is Dr. Hannah Little. Hannah, hello.
Hello.
Could you tell us a little bit about yourself, about your work, and about your involvement, your interest in digital rights?
So I'm a lecturer in science communication, but the thing that I'm really interested in communicating about or studying the communication of is sort of digital rights issues or data rights issues. And so I guess that's why you're talking to me, because a lot of the stories this week are about privacy.
Digital privacy. Who do we know at... Will yell at us about this whenever
I don't yell. Their house.
Probably it is our friend who has got stickers about digital rights and digital privacy all over her laptop.
I don't yell, come on.
Only sometimes.
Yeah.
Digital freedom is very much the order of the day, and we have a raft of press releases that have come through Eureka Alert from Penn State University. They seem to have a very active department looking at this sort of thing. And privacy. Information, the whole amount of what a smart device in your house listening to every word you say can glean about you. It turns out there's quite a lot of information that is just being given away.
And since we're all conducting most of our lives online currently, and there's been this news in the UK this week about the contact tracing app that the government has launched maybe not being
totally watertight,
it seems like a good time to talk about it.
Absolutely. I'm really enjoying the amount of public discussion about people's comfort around contact tracing apps, and people who've previously never said anything to me about any of this stuff talking about centralized and decentralized databases. And I'm like, wow, this is great.
Finally, they've listened.
Yeah, I mean, I don't even particularly know what those terms mean myself, but...
Well, I don't think most people do, which I think is why it's so exciting to me that people are having these conversations. I mean, it's not great. The situation clearly isn't great, right? I think we've all agreed that it's not ideal. But if it kind of creates a whole new generation of people who are kind of up to speed on the pros and cons of different information gathering approaches and being actively critical of it, I think that's a nice outcome. It's a silver lining.
So let's start off with one of the press releases from Penn State. Now, this press release was looking at the willingness of people to use social media information to log into other sites, other services, and other apps. And wouldn't you know, people aren't super keen on it, especially if they know a little bit or think they know a little bit about connectivity and about connected devices and how that information might be shared.
I mean, yeah, that it's not a surprising result, is it? I think the experimental condition they had where people were kind of like a bit more wary about plugging their Facebook login in was like dating sites for extramarital affairs. And yeah, I think that's fair enough. We all know what happened with Ashley Madison. That's the thing that happened in the real world. And a lot of people, it had horrific consequences for the users.
Yeah.
And I'm sure a lot of people have got sort of personal experiences where, for example, Instagram recommended that I follow my ex-boyfriend as soon as he joined because it's connected through other profiles and things, and like I don't ever want to interact with him in any way ever again. So having Instagram go, you should know that this person is here, you know, assuming that it probably said to him, you should know that this person is here.
Do you have your location turned on? Because then they can find you whenever.
Literally horrible. I blocked him immediately.
This is the thing that most people are kind of wary about when, for instance, Tinder asks you to log in using Facebook. And the reason that they do that is so that they know that you're a real person who uses the name that you have on that account. And in many ways, it's kind of increasing safety by forcing people to use their real name and use their real photographs. But I think that it also creates some problems as well, in that if you hook up Tinder to your Facebook and then you use photographs that are on your Facebook, people on Tinder can use photographs in reverse image searches to find your Facebook and find out who you are in the real world. And sometimes that's like maybe what people want, and that's fine. But sometimes that's definitely not what people want. And people are kind of understandably aware of that and a bit wary of it.
Yeah, there are some creeps out there on the internet. And if you've rejected somebody, the sort of safety risks of worrying about them coming to get you is, you know, the stuff that this study's talking about, where, you know, you could be outed for something else that you're using on a very public social media site, where you're trying to have a profile and a persona that is suitable for public consumption as opposed to part of a community that's into something a little bit more unusual.
There's a quote here from one of the authors, S. Shyamsunder, who is one of the professors at Penn State, who says that even though technically one's activities on Tinder will not be visible to friends on Facebook, they seem to have a psychological fear of that happening, so they want to keep their social networks separate and not have them bleed over into other parts of their lives. That particular sentence in the middle there, they seem to have a psychological fear of that happening. This feels like one of those things that, as authors and investigators, they could have checked and had a follow-up question of, tell us how you feel, why would you allow or not allow that, how, like, what emotional investment do you have on letting this information be
especially shared, since they did have some follow-up questions about perceived security, ease of sharing, and the usability of the app that they were using to test these things with.
Yeah, it might just be a kind of fear of qualitative data. So I think those things you just mentioned are quite easy to measure quantitatively, because you just do it on a scale. But this question of why, right, it's a big question, and people could probably write essays on it, and that requires qualitative analysis, and then some people balk at that.
I'm sure Penn State has a social psychology department who could probably weigh in and, like,
yeah, probably.
Just, like, lend an intern about. We've got some grad students who can probably talk you through why you should ask people how they feel when you're going to imagine how they might feel.
Yeah, even like, would some of your undergrads like to play with this data?
That seems like a useful thing to do. Maybe they're working on that and it'll be out in the next issue, but yeah, that feels like they've done the front half of a study here, and it's the back half that's really going to kind of open up more of the discussion.
I am interested in their, they mentioned that they recruited their participants through an online micro work site, which does seem like maybe not the ideal way to get a representative sample.
The Amazon Mechanical Turk micro site they've got for doing odd jobs.
I think the nice thing about Mechanical Turk is that you can literally collect thousands or millions of responses quite quickly. So even though a fair proportion of that data ends up being junk, the power you get from having such a massive sample almost outweighs that danger. And you can kind of mitigate it by having attention checks throughout your experiment or questionnaire. So you just have the odd question that kind of is a little bit challenging, but everybody should be able to answer, like, how many legs does a cat have? Just to make sure that people are actually paying attention and not just pressing random buttons, or they've set up a bot to kind of fill in things automatically.
This could be an entire episode of its own about research methods and data management. So
yeah, I mean, it's that, as with any other factor.
I just get defensive about it because I use Mechanical Turk.
It's, you know, it's like any other research method or sampling method. You just have to be aware of what its shortcomings are.
Yes.
And as you say, if you can power to, like, improve that signal-to-noise ratio or filter out what is and what is not useful, then that's fine and dandy. Speaking of things that are or might not be useful, we can move on to another piece of research from Penn State about smart devices, about Alexa. How about the privacy controls on the kinds of devices that we're looking at here? Because I don't have an Alexa or smart device because I am wary of privacy and security. Apparently that's something that a lot of people share, and the more you know about privacy, the more hyper-vigilant you become about it.
Yeah, so there's, like, some topics in science and technology communication where the more you know, the less you worry about it. And I think artificial intelligence is one of those things. People kind of worry about it until they know kind of where we're at, and then they're like, oh, okay.
Oh, no, actually, the robots are really stupid.
Yeah, I mean, they are. but privacy is one of those things where the more you know, people tend to worry more. But there is kind of this ongoing kind of debate around the amount of knowledge we should put into the hands of the users. Like, it's this whole question of whether data protection issues should be health standard regulations, right? Where every single time you eat a bit of cheese, you don't go and check if that bit of cheese has been subject to health standard law, right? You just assume that it has, and you eat it if you bought it in a shop. So should kind of data protection law or privacy law be like that, where we don't have to think about it, we just assume there's someone taking care of it for us? Or should it be more like road safety laws, where in order to use a car, to drive a car, you need to go through a whole rigmarole of tests and gather a load of information before you're allowed to do that, and make those choices on the road? That's a bit of a kind of extreme dichotomy, and the answer is probably somewhere in the middle. But it is kind of this ongoing interesting debate about, should people have to think about this stuff? And if you are making them think, and that's what this study is talking about, it's like saying, here, think about this. People then don't necessarily like thinking about it, or forcing them to think about it kind of makes them act in different ways than it would otherwise.
One of the things that they do point out in the press release is that with these sorts of devices, your privacy controls might affect the service that you get from the device. So if you're not saving your voice commands, it might not be able to sort of predict things for you quite so well. It might not put the things that you're actually interested in up the front of a list of recommendations that it's giving you.
The personalization that, in my case, have actively turned off is not going to be as personalized.
Yeah, I mean, you've turned off personalization for, like, adverts on the internet. I mean, it's so sweet how they always warn you that the adverts will be less useful to you. Like, yeah, I'm not trying to have you sell me things.
Yeah. And I think I am in favour of putting that power in the hands of the users and letting people decide whether they want targeted ads or otherwise. But targeted ads do have kind of consequences that people don't necessarily think of, because these algorithms collect universal data on you, and that data altogether can paint a pretty accurate, well, not accurate, sometimes accurate picture of who you are and what your behaviour is. And sometimes we have specific things about ourselves that we're not okay with the people around us knowing, even maybe people that we live with. And so there's been instances, there's a really nice case study. I think it was Target or maybe Walmart, one of the big supermarkets in America, were like taking data from people about logging what they bought and plugging that into an algorithm that was going to predict what they were going to buy next by using their loyalty card, and managed to work, well, the algorithm kind of accidentally managed to work out that if you have a certain buying pattern, you are pregnant, because pregnant people crave certain things, they need certain things. And so it kind of worked out this and sent this leaflet to this girl's house, targeting her as a kind of future mother. And her parents picked it up, and they were like really annoyed with the store for sending her this leaflet. Like, how dare you assume our daughter is pregnant and whatever. And then it turned out that she was, and the store had basically outed her pregnancy. And that's not okay.
There are things that people are keeping secret because it's a matter of safety. If it's your sexuality, if you're a teenager and you're pregnant and your parents are likely to take that news extremely badly, if you're trying to escape an abusive relationship, all that kind of stuff, you can put people at real physical risk.
Absolutely. And there's all sorts of sort of like correlates with people's sexuality that aren't necessarily overtly going on certain dating websites or whatever else, that kind of make it more likely that your tech will accidentally out you.
Yeah, I mean, if you've watched Buffy the Vampire Slayer more than 3 times in the last 10 years, it's possible you're a queer woman.
I feel personally attacked.
Could a lot of your music taste be described as a sad boy with a violin? You might be a gay.
Hannah, please know that I also am speaking from a place of personal experience.
I know.
There is a lot that algorithms and the information that we surrender to them can be very, very intelligent, and a lot of it can also be dumb as hell, in my personal experience.
We talk about targeted advertising. I know when I was working at the credit union, we were trying to use Facebook advertising to kind of target groups of people who may wish to borrow from us. You could really whittle those groups down to like handfuls of people, which seems like an alarming way to be able to put very specific messages in front of very specific people.
Which is why you should turn your personalization off. Get adverts on Wish for leather jackets in Kyrgyzstan made out of vegan leather, which come actually in sizes intended for dogs. That's the kind of personalization I would be comfortable with receiving on the internet.
Is that what you shop for?
That's what I should start shopping for, to try and throw off the algorithm. Build an entire second identity, an entire secret persona of someone who's setting up a dog shop boutique in Kyrgyzstan.
And they're like, this is who William Mountford is.
Yeah. Well, there's my retirement plan if all this goes sideways. Anyway, on to the web of psychological cues may tempt people to reveal more online. Apparently, I've just gone and outed myself for having a secret identity as a dog groomer. So, well played, internet.
And this is a part of the internet that's almost entirely under your control. It's your podcast.
Entirely.
This is a, you know, this is a kind of a social thing as much as anything of if you see other people sharing something, you're like, oh, it's time to share this information about myself because we're trying to bond.
The whole paper read to me like a toolkit for hackers, how to get personal information from people.
Yeah, not even necessarily hackers, yeah. Just people who want to manipulate.
Con artists.
Yeah.
But that's what hackers do. I mean, like, nearly all hacks are just social engineering. They're not technical in nature.
They hacked my brain.
Sometimes,
man.
They, of course, they're technical in it. Yeah, yeah. I mean, like, all phishing attacks. Mr. Robot taught us that.
That should go onto the lockdown watch list. You've been endorsing it for so long, and I've still not seen it.
Oh, I mean, the accuracy of the hacking in it is... You should watch it for that alone.
So, less Johnny Lee Miller, Hack the Planet, more Mentalist.
I haven't seen The Mentalist. It is not similar to Hackers, the film. It's like the opposite of that in vibe.
Wasn't Johnny Lee Miller also a Sherlock Holmes? Yeah, maybe that's the era of Johnny Lee Miller we should be targeting. One is and one is not the right kind of discovering psychology for evil means.
Except he wasn't that kind of Sherlock Holmes either, was he?
I don't know, I never saw it.
Also, it's not evil means, he's trying to solve crimes.
I saw one bit of an episode of Elementary in which Lucy Liu walked into a room and said, "The boys down the station got this." Slaps a file down on the table and it's the bad guy's face and address. So all of the detective work was done by the detectives of NYPD, and you're just going to go and have a dramatic monologue session with your dad? Okay. It didn't grip me, but maybe I should give that another go as well. Anyway, the psychology behind the vulnerabilities and the steering of how you might surrender your information that they identify in this paper is a pre-existing belief about authority, the bandwagon approach, which, as Leah mentioned, is if you see other people sharing stuff, you think, okay, I will share this as well. Reciprocity, giving information back when it's been given by other people. Sense of community, community building, self-preservation, control, which is not explained much further. Instant gratification, transparency. Machine, which is not explained at all, and is only full of questions of what does machine mean in this context. Publicness and mobility. Somewhere between all of those 12 is a way to get you to, well, maybe make you more likely to give up a little bit more about yourself than you might originally intend.
It is quite dangerous information to put out into the world, isn't it? Like, this is how you manipulate people into giving you information on the internet, including your social security number.
I think lots of people just manage to figure it out for themselves, like through social interactions. So is it that dangerous if all the people who were likely to do it have figured it out for themselves anyway?
Yeah. It's almost certainly the case that companies like LinkedIn have already done this research through A/B testing, where they have like two versions of the website. And one of them says 70% of successful users of LinkedIn have shared this information, you should give us this information. And one of them doesn't say that. And then they look at how much that affects people's ability to give over the information. And they've found that that has worked. And so they've kept it. It's just now that academics are kind of coming along and then testing this and publicly releasing the information to everybody rather than just LinkedIn keeping it behind closed doors. And I don't know, maybe it levels the playing field a little bit, as well as it being dangerous for other reasons.
It's got the potential to make us all aware of the things that they're using to try and get us to reveal things so that we can go, oh, I know that trick, I'm not falling for it.
Like when, after it was exposed how many pickup artists were using variations on neuro-linguistic programming and negging and all like their insidious techniques to try and get women to lower their self-esteem enough to sleep with them, all those techniques instantly stopped working because now the world knows.
Someone tried negging me once. I didn't really know what it was at the time. I hadn't encountered the term before, but someone in a bar looked me up and down and went, "You'll do." And I went, "You won't." Because how else are you supposed to react to that?
I don't know. I'm not a pickup artist. I am, by all regards, an all right person, so I cannot relate. We're delving into a different side of psychology here. We should stick to the privacy stuff. But first, quick break.
We're queer.
We're geeks.
We're queeks.
Superheroes, Star Wars,
Broadway, Drag Race.
So if you're super gay,
super nerdy,
or anything in between, listen to Queeks today.
Wherever fine podcasts are sold.
And find us on Instagram at Queeks Podcast.
This one from the University of Cincinnati, which asks a question of who else might be listening in on your Alexa?
Now this one is spooky as all hell.
So this is about kind of vulnerabilities that can exist with kind of Internet of Things devices, where you have lots of devices that are all connected to each other and speaking to each other. And it talks about a specific way that you can extract some information as it travels from the device to the cloud.
They built 1,000 traces for 100 common voice commands, so that the network packet that's sent to the cloud every time you give Alexa a voice command, they can create predictable traffic patterns from that.
Yeah. So this is exactly the kind of research I would expect the makers or designers of these products to be doing, and not necessarily just academics who've got funding from the National Science Foundation. But I guess it's good that somebody's doing it who can be completely transparent about it. But I do wonder if the right people are paying for this research to happen, and if we should just be... It's tricky, isn't it? I don't know the answer.
Well, the affiliations are to Boyang Wang, an assistant professor at UC College of Engineering and Applied Science, and to UC graduate Sean Kennedy, who, it says, now conducts research for a Fortune 500 company called Leidos at Air Force Research Lab at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. So he's working for the military about this now.
Well, not necessarily about this, but I would say it probably is unequivocally positive that the research has happened, because we need to know that that's what it is, and that it's... I mean, because people don't really trust research that is funded or backed or conducted by the company that it's about.
Whereas if someone else can identify a vulnerability and be public about it, then you can get that vulnerability addressed.
Yeah, and somebody who's doing it in an academic context rather than some hackers doing it and then not telling anyone and just using it for malicious means.
And this is something that does come up every time people are talking about the problems with an Internet of Things. Why does your fridge need to be clever?
Just reminded of that episode of Silicon Valley where they have a smart fridge that talks and then they hack it.
I seem to remember there being a news story about someone's like internet-connected coffee machine or something being hacked.
I have seen mutterings in other press releases and papers that unsecured devices being used as a way into a smart house.
Yeah.
If you can drive by someone and like get into their smart espresso, their smart fridge, and then use that to get into the rest of their network, open their garage door, and you're in.
Yeah, like the toaster or something. And it's like, why the hell is your toaster connected to the internet? And this is before you even get into the stuff about like the computers in people's cars being used to break them remotely or being used to prevent you repairing your tractor without taking it to the right dealership.
Or the Internet of Things connected sex toys.
Yeah.
A different kind of exposing vulnerability there. But someone somewhere is doing the research, and I guess... yeah, that is the important thing, that research happens and that we get data and that we can make better decisions based on it. Which comes back, in a very roundabout way, to the contact tracing apps being, I'm not going to say prematurely released across England, but Hannah, any thoughts if people should be...
I am going to say... So, yeah, I don't think it is incorrect to say that they have been prematurely released. I strongly believe that they... have been prematurely released just because the government haven't released a privacy impact assessment on the app in its current form, which the Information Commissioner Office has asked for, and the government just haven't given them one and have started an entire trial on the Isle of Wight. So everybody in the Isle of Wight is in this trial now, and they might be doing something illegal because they haven't given this impact assessment to the Information Commissioner's Office. And they should be aware of the law because they made it.
You mean the current UK Tory government might have done something illegal?
This is the trouble, is like that's not even inconsistent with the way they've been behaving. And I'm so tired.
So the problems with the app in its current form, that the UK app, I'll stress, not the app as it exists in other countries, is that they're using a centralized database, which creates, first of all, it creates kind of technical problems with how the app operates on your phone. So it doesn't work on a lot of devices, and kind of having Bluetooth running in the background when the phone is locked to do what it wants to do is quite problematic without kind of...
Oh,
yes,
my God.
Bluetooth. But the decentralized version also runs on Bluetooth. There's no way to do this without Bluetooth, right? So that's not necessarily the problem. But the problem is the technical problems with it working in the first place. So at least 60% of the population need to have this app and need to have it working in order for it to be even a little bit effective at what it does. But there's a bigger problem on top of that, which is this problem of privacy, where if you have a centralized database and everybody's data that the app collects gets sent to a big database that the government has, they're basically creating a big database with all that information sat in it, rather than just having the information held locally on your device. It doesn't get sent anywhere, and it only alerts you when it detects that you come into contact with somebody else who also has the information locally on their device that they have been diagnosed with the virus. That's a decentralized system, and that's a lot better for privacy than the centralized version. But I think, like, as of yesterday, I think the government are making some sounds that sound like they might be kind of binning the idea of a centralized database because the app isn't working. And, you know, they've been warned about this because Colombia tried to do a centralized version and it didn't work, so they binned it. Australia tried to do a centralized version and it didn't work, so they binned it. Germany tried to do a centralized version and it didn't work, so they binned it. And now everybody's acting all surprised.
Hey, England has not learned a damn thing from anyone else's coronavirus experience on any front, and I don't see why that should change now.
Yeah. So basically, I think my prediction is what's going to happen is that we're going to revert to Google and Apple's API, which is this decentralized version, which is preferred by security experts and privacy experts, in the same way that Germany are and Australia are and everybody else is, because it works. And even if they're not doing it because it's better for kind of privacy rights, I'm okay with that decision because I think it's the correct one.
Yeah, I mean, it does need to function.
Yeah.
Is also quite important.
This is a passing thought entirely, but the Conservative Party conference last year, the year before last, they had an app for attendees, right?
That dumped everybody's information right into someone's lap, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm. Mm. Wonder if it's the same company.
They're so good at this. And the UK government are just so competent.
They're in charge.
Yeah, it's a little bit worrying.
It's a little bit of a downer to end on, but, well, that's 2020.
I mean, I can just yeah, quote sorry. This one from the study about people potentially listening in on your Alexa. Perhaps tellingly, while Wang keeps 6 or 7 smart speakers to study in his UC lab, he doesn't take any home.
So he's handling it the same way that people treat radioactive samples. Like, fine to study, but do not take your work home.
I mean, possibly he is now working from home. We don't know.
That's true. Well, Hannah, if people do want to stay up to date on what is being done to protect their online rights and their online identities, what would be the best way for them to do that?
My number one suggestion would be to become a member of Open Rights Group, which you can find them at openrightsgroup.org. And they send out frequent updates to everybody about kind of what's happening with their digital rights. One thing they're doing at the minute is they're the guys who are launching a legal battle against NHSX, the app, the centralized app, over the fact that they didn't kind of release the data protection impact assessment to kind of just establish whether they have done something illegal, which I think it's important to have that body there keeping people in check and making sure there's accountability at the level of government. Yeah, and they also do a lot of work kind of keeping private companies into account with things like ad tech and the Internet of Things, which we've been talking about as well. They're super good guys.
And if they want to stay in touch with you and anything, is there any social media that you'd rather they do that through? You can say no, because seeing as we spend this entire time saying you're being spied on, don't let them spy on you. By the way, follow us on Twitter.
No, I mean, my Twitter's public. Anyone can follow me on Twitter. It's at Hanachronism. That's an H and then the word anachronism.
Well then, thank you very much for your time and stay safe.
Yeah, lovely to have a catch-up with you.
Thanks for having me on. And you also stay safe.
We are at Eureka Nerdcast on Twitter. You can find us at EurekaNerdcast@gmail.com or on Facebook /EurekaNerd.
And if you enjoy the podcast and want to support us, then you can donate to us via Patreon for ongoing contributions.
Also, don't forget to check out the rest of the shows on the Stimulus Network. You can find all of those at stimulus.network. Until next time, that's bye-bye from me.
And goodbye from me.